Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners. From VOA Learning English, this is As It Is. I'm Mario Ritter. The Pew Research Center says the number of stay-at-home dads in the U.S. has tripled in the last 25 years. Today, Ana Mateo brings us a report about two men and their roles as stay-at-home dads. Ana spoke with R.J. and Blake, two stay-at-home dads in the Washington, D.C. area. First, we explain some vocabulary used in this report. Masculine is an adjective describing something or someone having qualities usually associated with a man. And the idiomatic expression, to lay it on the line, means to be direct and honest about something. We now bring you Ana's original report on stay-at-home dads in the U.S.
It's 4 o'clock on a Wednesday at a private swimming pool in the Washington, D.C. area. Two fathers talk about getting their kids ready for a baseball-themed birthday party that evening. Both fathers are trying to get their sons dried, dressed, and ready to get in the car.
Okay. If you see Ben, tell him he needs to get changed.
R.J. Respris has been a stay-at-home dad for the past 10 years. He has a 10-year-old son named Ben and a 7-year-old daughter named Sophie. Being a stay-at-home dad now, he says, is much different than it was 10 years ago.
And so when I first started staying home, there weren't a lot of dads around. And being home as a dad at that point was... You definitely stood out. I stood out. But now I don't think it makes a lot of difference, honestly. I think everyone seems to know about it. It's not peculiar. You see them all the time.
He is right. A new study finds that in the U.S., more than 2 million fathers are staying home to take care of the house and family. This number is twice that of 25 years ago. In 2012, 16% of all parents in the U.S. were stay-at-home dads. Like R.J., Blake Humphreys has also been a stay-at-home dad for the past 10 years. Blake and his partner have two kids, a 10-year-old son named Aiden and a 9-year-old daughter named Camille.
I am a stay-at-home dad, and I have been a stay-at-home dad for 10 years, a decade. And I know that just saying it sounds scary to me right now.
Blake became a stay-at-home parent for the same reason many women do. He made less money than his partner. He thought it would be easy. Then he got advice from an expert on the subject, the woman who raised his partner.
I was like, oh, I can do this. Yes, that's easy. Paul's mom came to me and was like, are you sure this is what you want to do? This is what it's like. And she laid it on the line about how challenging it was for her in the 70s being a stay-at-home parent.
When asked about the most difficult part of being a stay-at-home dad, RJ and Blake give the same answer: feeling alone or isolated. Both dads say they miss the interactions with coworkers at their former jobs. RJ worked at an investment bank, and Blake worked at a nonprofit organization supporting gay rights.
Being a stay-at-home dad, it's a lot harder than what I had in my mind that it was going to be like.
Why?
Well, I think because it became kind of isolating, and you just have to know how to manage that.
RJ remembers taking his children to many activities where the fathers would be on one side of the room and the mothers would be on the other. He says they wouldn't talk to each other.
so it was really funny walking into these shows because the dads would sit on one side of the room and then the moms would sit on the other side of the room, and it was like a junior high school dance. It was really funny to see from the outside, like, why aren't the men talking to the women? It was.
Even though the number of stay-at-home fathers is growing in the U.S., such men can still face worries about their self-worth.
We are going to take a short break. When we return, we will hear more of Anna's conversations with RJ and Blake about being a stay-at-home dad in the U.S. Welcome back. You are listening to As It Is. Today, Anna brings us a report about two stay-at-home dads. Anna spoke with RJ and Blake, two stay-at-home dads in the Washington, D.C. area. We return to her report.
RJ and Blake both shared their feelings of anxiety. Blake volunteers at his children's school, partly, he says, to battle that isolation and to build up his sense of self-worth. Volunteering became like a part-time job. He says it adds value to his life and his family's life.
And I think because of being a stay-at-home dad, I would almost be overly involved. I would try to turn it into a part-time job doing volunteer work, because I would see value, that added value to, not only my life, but it added value to my kids' school life.
RJ Respris feels the same way. He volunteers at his children's school, coaches his son's baseball team, and organizes all after-school activities. RJ has recently begun a part-time paying job from home, but he says his job as stay-at-home dad comes first.
And I do work. And I work, not full-time, but I work from home, and I'm able to work part-time, and that allows my family the ability to coordinate schedules with the kids' activities. And
I'm stay-at-home dads may question their self-worth because they are not bringing money into the family directly, a role traditionally connected to fathers. Blake says he began to question his masculinity.
No, you question your masculinity because you're not bringing money in. You question the value that you're adding to the family, even though if you look at it, you are adding the most value to the family because you are taking care of everything, the daily operations of your family.
School is letting out.
Going back to work is also a question of economics for Blake and his family. If he goes back to work, they will have to pay someone to pick up their kids from school, to drive them to sports and other activities, and to babysit when both parents are at work. And just spending time with their children is valuable to both men. In fact, when RJ told his former coworkers that he would be taking time off from work to look after his newborn son, the reaction was not what he expected.
They never really saw their kids very, very much. Most of the older guys saying, really enjoy that time because you don't get that time back. And that's huge. Hang on one second. Yeah? So our bag is over here.
I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Mario Ritter. Join us tomorrow for another As It Is.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
And welcome to the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. Independence Day is a huge celebration in the United States. People celebrate by having parades and picnics, and usually end the day with fireworks. So, what do some of these words mean? Parade. Cities and towns, large and small, across the U.S., close their main streets to make way for Independence Day parades. Clean and shiny fire trucks and school marching bands parade down the streets lined with people watching and cheering. Parade floats, which are decorated vehicles, carry local stars, like the child who won the spelling bee, or the winner of a local beauty contest. People work very hard making a parade. So the worst thing to happen on parade day is rain. To rain on someone's parade is to ruin something for someone else. Here's an example. I hate to rain on your parade, but the guy you like is not coming to the party. Picnic. On Independence Day, people in the U.S. like to eat outside. Friends, family, and neighbors will come together and picnic. Picnics are easy and fun. So when something is difficult, we say it is no picnic. Taking the TOEFL exam is no picnic. I studied for months, and it was still so hard. Fireworks. Many people around the world celebrate important days with fireworks, including the United States. Independence Day fireworks shows are explosive, bright, and colorful. The word fireworks can be used in other situations, both good and bad. For example, if two people are having a fiery argument, others may tell them to stop all the fireworks. Fireworks in this case are a bad thing. But good fireworks are exciting and beautiful, like falling in love. A kiss or touch of a lover's hand can create fireworks between two people, even couples who have been married for many years but who are deeply in love can have fireworks explode each time they kiss. If you want to see real fireworks in the U.S., visit during the 4th of July. The U.S. traditionally celebrates its freedom with huge outdoor public gatherings and fireworks at night. In Washington, D.C., for example, large crowds gather near the Washington Monument to listen to music and watch a big fireworks show. In other cities and smaller towns, local people also listen to concerts and watch fireworks explode after dark. They also play songs that celebrate the American dream. You might hear Neil Diamond's America, a song that honors the American dream and America's immigrant experience. Some songs are about the dream of the American dream, one that perhaps did not happen. In his song, American Tune, famous singer-songwriter Paul Simon paints a more complex view of the American experience. He sings of weariness, hard work, and homesickness, but promises that in the end, it will be all right. And I dreamed I was flying, and high up above, my eyes could clearly see the Statue of Liberty sailing away to sea. And I dreamed I was flying. I'm Ana Mateo. Oh, we come on the ship they call the Mayflower.
come on the ship that sailed the moon. We come in the ages most uncertain hours and sing an American tune. Oh, and it's all right. It's all right, it's all right. You can't be forever blessed. Still, tomorrow's gonna be another working day, and I'm trying to get some rest. That's all, I'm trying to get some rest.
I'm Shirley Griffith.
And I'm Tony Riggs with People in America. Today, we tell about writer Willa Cather.
The second half of the 19th century brought major changes to the United States. From its earliest days, America had been an agricultural society. But after the end of the Civil War in 1865, the country became increasingly industrial. And as the population grew, America became less unified. After railroads linked the Atlantic coast with the Pacific coast, the huge Middle West of the country was open to settlement. The people who came were almost all from Europe. There were Swedes and Norwegians, Poles and Russians, Bohemians and Germans. Many of them failed in their new home. Some fled back to their old homeland. But those who suffered through the freezing winters and the burning summers and the failed crops became the new pioneers. They were the men and women celebrated by the American writer Willa Cather.
Cather's best stories are about these pioneers. She told what they sought and what they gained. She wrote of their difficult relations with those who followed, and she developed a way of writing, both beautiful and simple, that made her a pioneer too. For many women in the 19th century, writing novels was just one of the things they did. For Willa Cather, writing was her life.
Willa Cather was born in the southern state of Virginia in 1873. At the age of 8, her family moved to the new state of Nebraska in the Middle West. She and Nebraska grew up together. Willa lived in the small town of Red Cloud. As a child, she showed writing ability. And she was helped by good teachers, who were uncommon in the new frontier states. Few women of her time went to a university. Willa Cather, however, went to the University of Nebraska. She wrote for the university literary magazine, among her other activities. She graduated from the university in 1895.
Most American writers of her time looked to the eastern United States as the cultural center of the country. It was a place where exciting things were possible. It was an escape from the flatness of the land and culture of the Middle West. From 1896 to 1901, Cather worked for the Pittsburgh Daily Leader newspaper. It was in Pennsylvania, not New York, but it was farther east than Nebraska.
Cather began to publish stories and poems in 1900, and she became an English teacher in 1901. For 5 years, she taught English at Pittsburgh Central High School and at nearby Allegheny High School. She published her first book in 1903. It was a book of poetry. 2 years later, she published a book of stories called The Troll Garden.
The owner of a New York magazine, S.S. McClure, read her stories. He asked her to come to New York City and work as an editor at McClure's magazine. She was finally in the cultural capital of the country. She stayed with the magazine from 1906 to 1912. One of the people who influenced her to leave the magazine was the American woman writer Sarah Orne Jewett. Jewett advised Cather to write only fiction and to deal with the places and characters she knew best. Jewett said it was the only way to write anything that would last.
In 1912, Willa Cather published her first novel, Alexander's Bridge. By that time, Cather had enough faith in herself to leave magazine work and use all her time to write fiction. She remembered Jewett's advice and turned to the land and people she knew best, the farmers of the Middle West. In Red Cloud, she had lived among Bohemians, French Canadians, Germans, Scandinavians, and other immigrants. She saw that the mixture of all these new Americans produced a new society. There was nothing but land, she wrote, not a country at all, but the material out of which countries are made. It was this material she used to create her books.
Like all good writers, she wanted her novels to show the world she described, not just tell about it. Later in her life, she described the way she wrote. She called it novels without furniture. What she meant was that she removed from her novels everything that was not necessary to tell the story. Fiction in the 19th century was filled with social detail. It had pages of description and comments by the author. Cather did not write this way. She looked to the past for her ideas, but she drew from the present for her art. A year after Alexander's Bridge, Cather published her second novel. It was the first of her books to take place in the Middle West. It is called O Pioneers. It established her as one of the best writers of her time. O Pioneers tells the story of the first small groups of Bohemians, Czechs, French, Russians, and Swedes who set about to conquer the land. Cather said they acted as if they were a natural force, as strong or stronger than nature. She said they were people who owned the land for a little while because they loved it. Spring, summer, autumn, winter, spring, Cather wrote. Always the same field, trees, lives.
Cather's heroes are pioneers, settlers of unknown or unclaimed land. They also are pioneers of the human spirit. They are, Cather said, the people who would dream great railroads across the continent. Yet she saw something more in them. It was something permanent within a world of continuous change, a sense of order in what appeared to be disorder. In Cather's mind, Her writings about the Middle West, her prairie years, became a way to show approval of the victory of traditional values against countless difficulties. The fight to remain human and in love with life in spite of everything gives the people in her stories purpose and calm.
Willa Cather continued to write about these new pioneers in The Song of the Lark in 1915. She followed that with the novel that many consider her best, My Antonia. By the 1920s, however, her stories began to change. She saw more defeats, fewer victories. She began to write not about great dreams, but about the smallness of man's vision. She mourned for the loss of values others would never miss. Willa Cather never married. She began living with another woman from Nebraska in 1908. They lived together until Cather died. In 1922, Cather suffered a nervous breakdown. A number of things caused her condition. Her health was not good. She was unhappy with her publisher. And she was angry about the changes in society brought by new technology. In 1923, Cather wrote the last of her Nebraska novels, A Lost Lady. 2 years later, she produced another novel, The Professor's House. It was clear by then that she was moving in a different direction.
Her next two novels, Death Comes for the Archbishop and Shadows in the Rock, take place in the distant past. They are stories about heroic failure. Death Comes for the Archbishop takes place in the American Southwest in the 16th century. It describes the experiences of two priests who are sent to what became New Mexico. The action is in the past, but the place is one that Cather felt always would remain the same, the deserts of the American Southwest. Where her earlier books described a person's search for solid ground, these books describe the solid ground itself. They came from a deep unhappiness with modern life.
Although Cather turned away from modern life, she was very much a modern writer. Her writing became increasingly important to a new group of writers, Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and John Dos Passos. Near the end of her life, she wrote, "Nothing really matters but living. Get all you can out of it. I am an old woman, and I know. Sometimes people disappoint us, and sometimes we disappoint ourselves. But the thing is to go right on living." Willa Cather went right on living until the age of 74. She died in 1947.
This special English program was written by Richard Thorman. I'm Tony Riggs.
And I'm Shirley Griffith. Join us again next week for another People in America program on The Voice of America.